From NPR News, this is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Audie Cornish. Today, we're looking back on a decade shaped by terrorism on U.S. soil. We'll hear sound from the morning's commemorations in Lower Manhattan, at the Pentagon, and in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. There, the president, accompanied by the first lady, attended a wreath-laying ceremony to honor the lives lost aboard United Flight 93. And Haitian writer Edwige Dantica on why 9/11 sticks so firmly in our collective memory.
For my father, who had lived in Haiti through a 30-year dictatorship and had seen many horrible things, this was still the most horrible thing.
Those stories and more. But first, our newscast.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. Remembrances are underway today in New York City at the Pentagon and near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where four hijacked planes crashed 10 years ago today. The first plane plunged into the World Trade Center in New York, followed minutes later by a second. At that site today, dignitaries and relatives of those who died gathered as they do every year. Mayor Michael Bloomberg was the first speaker.
In all the years that Americans have looked to these ceremonies, we have shared both words and silences. The words of writers and poets have helped express what is in our hearts. The silences have given us a chance to reflect and remember.
Among the writers, poets, and musicians today was Paul Simon.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again.
A similar ceremony was held this morning at the Pentagon. NPR's Rachel Martin reports members of the active duty military paid tribute to the 184 people who died there.
At one point during the memorial, 184 members of the U.S. military from representing all the services, each very carefully, very slowly, one at a time, placed a bouquet of white flowers on each bench. And it was a very powerful tribute. I talked with family members after the conclusion of that ceremony, and they just said it was something that moved them a great deal.
NPR's Rachel Martin reporting from the Pentagon. President Obama laid a wreath near Shanksville, Pennsylvania a short while ago to honor the passengers and crew aboard United Flight 93, which crashed into a field 10 years ago today. Some of the boys aboard tried to stop the hijackers, who apparently intended to crash the plane in Washington, about 20 minutes away by air. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett said those who died charted a new course, a new standard for bravery. Former Governor Tom Ridge, the first head of Homeland Security, thanked the approximately 2,000 people who came to the memorial. Police in Sweden have arrested four people in a suspected terrorist plot. Terry Schultz reports it's not clear if there's a connection to today's 9/11 anniversary.
Along with the four arrests, police in Sweden's second-largest city, Göteborg, evacuated hundreds of guests from a gala art opening just after midnight. In a statement, police say they took the action due to a threat that implied serious danger to lives, health, or extensive property damage, but they're giving no other details. Sara Kvarnström of the National Security Service tells the Swedish Daily Dagens Nyheter authorities don't believe there's further cause for public concern. The evacuation order was lifted in early morning. A year ago, Sweden raised its terror threat level from low to elevated. Last December, a suicide bomber blew himself up in downtown Stockholm, but killed only himself. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Egypt's military ruler will not appear at the trial of the former president, Hosni Mubarak, until later this month. NPR's Soraya Sahani Nelson reports his testimony was delayed because the ruling military council is still dealing with the international fallout from a mob attack on the Israeli embassy in Cairo over the weekend.
Field Marshal Hossein Tantawi was to testify, but according to news reports, sent a note to the judge saying he couldn't make it. If Tantawi does take the stand on September 24th, he will likely be asked about who in the Egyptian government gave the orders to stop protesters at all costs. Prosecutors are trying to prove that Mubarak and his interior minister, Habib al-Adli, are linked to the police killing some 850 protesters during the uprising that ousted the men from power. If convicted, they could face the death penalty. Mubarak and Adli's trial resumes Tuesday with former vice president and intelligence chief Omar Suleiman expected to testify, but the Egyptian interim government has banned coverage of his testimony, as it is doing with Tantawi. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
The island nation of Zanzibar has begun 3 days of official mourning for more than 200 people killed when a ferry sank this weekend off the East African coast. The government says many people are missing. The BBC's Hassan Halela reports.
I've just come out of a press briefing by a minister responsible for emergency disasters who appeared to admit that the vessel had overloaded passengers as well as cargo. The ferry has a capacity of 600 passengers and 500 tons, but at the time of the accident, it had more than 800 passengers. What the government has been telling us is that at the moment, they are concentrating on burying the identified bodies as well as those which have not been identified by their relatives.
The BBC's Hassan Halela reporting from Zanzibar. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington. From NPR News, this is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Audie Cornish. Around the country and around the world, people are marking the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Official ceremonies began early today in New York City at Ground Zero, where the twin towers of the World Trade Center once stood. This morning, amid tight security, with Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush in attendance, the somber day began with the Brooklyn Youth Chorus singing the national anthem. At 8:46 a.m., the time American Airlines Flight 11 struck the North Tower, came the first of the day's moments of silence. Then President Obama read Psalm 46.
God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling, there is a river whose stream shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn. The nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come behold the works of the Lord. Was made desolations in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob. Is our refuge.
Nearly 3,000 people were killed on this day 10 years ago. Today, their loved ones read their names at Ground Zero.
Gordon A. Amath, Jr.
Delamero Abad.
Marie Rose Abad.
Andrew Anthony Abate.
Vincent Paul Abate.
President George W. Bush read a letter written by Abraham Lincoln.
In the fall of 1864, he learned that a widow had lost 5 sons in the Civil War, and he wrote her this letter. Dear Madam, I have been shown in the files of the War Department a statement of the Adjutant General of Massachusetts that you're the mother of 5 sons who have died gloriously on the field of battle. I feel how weak and fruitless must be any words of mine which should attempt to beguile you from the grief of a loss so overwhelming. But I cannot refrain from tendering to you the consolation that may be found in the thanks of the Republic they died to save. I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement and leave you only the cherished memory of the loved and lost, and the solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar of freedom. Yours very sincerely and respectfully, Abraham Lincoln.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
Ceremonies continued with the singing of Amazing Grace at the Pentagon, just outside Washington, D.C., where a third passenger plane commandeered by terrorists crashed on September 11th.
Was blind, but now I see.
And in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, a ceremony is underway at the site where the fourth hijacked plane crashed. No company suffered on September 11th as much as the bond broker Cantor Fitzgerald, which lost 658 people. One of the few Cantor employees to survive that day was Lauren Manning. She was in the lobby of Tower 1 when the plane hit and was burned over 80% of her body. Now she's written a book about her long recovery. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
There's a photo of Lauren Manning on the cover of her book, Unmeasured Strength. She's standing defiantly on a Manhattan street, her hands on her hips, in a sleeveless dress that exposes her burned arms.
It's a photo of strength. I wanted to be powerful. I needed to be.
When the attacks occurred, Manning was a hard-charging 40-year-old Cantor Fitzgerald executive who had just had her first child. She was rushing to an elevator when the first plane hit and was instantly engulfed in flames. Dr. Roger Yurt, who heads the burn center at Weill Cornell Medical Center, says when Manning arrived there, her odds of survival were just 25%.
Somebody with an injury as big as she had has compromise of the immune function. And so we are trying to get their burn wound healed as soon as possible so that they don't get infection in their wounds.
Manning's pain was so severe, she had to be put in a coma to be treated. She awoke weeks later, unable to talk or move very much. Greg Manning waited a while before telling his wife how many of her colleagues at Cantor Fitzgerald had died.
We were simply told, let Lauren ask questions and answer those questions. Don't volunteer information. Don't jump ahead. Don't go, by the way, something absolutely horrible has happened.
Finally, I said, you know, but who did make it? You know, what did happen? And on that particular day, he told me, and I will never forget it. I mean, I was racked by pain, but it seemed secondary, and I took absolute personal responsibility that they wouldn't get another one. They weren't going to take me out.
Doctors said Manning had about 18 months to regain flexibility in her limbs, or she might lose it forever. So she took hours of physical therapy every day. She endured skin grafts and painful hydrotherapy to clean her wounds. She was fed through a feeding tube.
It was one of my great milestones when the doctor said I could have a piece of ice.
Ice?
Ice, yeah, ice. My mouth was so dry and parched, and to feel it finally slide down my throat, I felt like I was, you know, quenching a thirst that had existed, quite literally for months.
Slowly but surely, she learned to walk and use her badly burned hands. Manning is the daughter of a Marine, and she has worked for years in the unforgiving pressure cooker that is Wall Street. And she says that taught her the determination she needed to get better.
You just have to move on. Why not? What's the alternative? You know, have your pity party, but don't make it last too long.
Manning also had to live in a certain amount of denial about all that had happened to her.
In a sense, I created a charade of how I would be, how I would look to the world, how I would interact. I was incredibly positive. I never acknowledged a sense of feeling weak or incredibly fatigued. And I didn't dwell on the physical changes.
Those changes were considerable. The skin on her back and arms was scarred. She lost part of an ear and the tips of some of her fingers. But she's had multiple surgeries, especially on her hands. Her long blonde hair has grown back. She dresses well, and she no longer attracts stares like she used to. Dr. Roger Yurt says Manning's attitude played no small part in her recovery.
What I learned from her is the importance of your makeup and your determination and your ability to fight through things. A lot of people would have given up and never made it as far as she's made it.
Because Manning lived when so many others died, she has become an icon of survival. She sometimes gives interviews and makes public appearances. And once a year, she and her husband attend the memorial service for Cantor Fitzgerald employees. They're doing so again this weekend. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Listening to live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News.
You're listening to live coverage here on 90.3 WPLN Nashville Public Radio. Support for our programming comes from WPLN listener members. Support the programming you value on Nashville Public Radio with a pledge today. You'll be entered in a drawing for a 9-day tour of England, Scotland, and Wales for two. You can pledge now at WPLN.org, and that drawing will be held Friday, September 23rd. It's 18 minutes after 11, 74 degrees in Nashville.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. There's been a suicide attack against an American military base in eastern Afghanistan. NATO says a Taliban truck bomb exploded at the gate, wounding 77 U.S. troops. Four Afghan civilians died. The anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr says he's ordered a halt to attacks on U.S. troops. He's calling on his followers to suspend attacks to ensure American troops leave Iraq by the year-end deadline. And in tennis, the spotlight at the U.S. Open in New York is on the women's final today. Serena Williams will be taking on Australian Samantha Stosur. The men's final between Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal is set for tomorrow. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington. From NPR News, this is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Audie Cornish. In ceremonies across the country and around the world, 9/11 victims are being remembered. Heroes are being honored. Monuments are being dedicated. We've been watching and listening to ceremonies in New York, at the Pentagon, and in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. I'm joined in the studio by national security correspondent Tom Gelton and national political correspondent Don Gagne. Welcome to you both.
Hi there, Wadi.
Don, you've covered the Bush administration in its entirety. Talk about how 9/11 changed its course.
There was a very sharp turn. Pre-9/11, the administration was about education and immigration and talking about tax cuts. Tax cut talk certainly continued, but essentially there was then just this quick change. It became about national security. President Bush became a wartime president. He said he became one reluctantly, but he certainly embraced that role. We saw the Bush Doctrine created, which called for preemptive strikes against potential threats around the world. And it's also worth saying that that the events of 9/11 played a pretty big role in President Bush's reelection and gave him a second term.
To go back to President George Bush for a moment, how did this affect his legacy?
Both positive and negative. There were no further attacks beyond 9/11 during his time in the White House, and some high-profile plots were foiled. So there's certainly, you know, a good chunk of the public that gives him credit for keeping the country safe. In Afghanistan, the Taliban was overthrown. But on the other side of the ledger, you have the Iraq War, justifications for the Iraq War, the lack of WMDs, which were the big justification for the war. Toss in, you know, Abu Ghraib and enhanced interrogation measures and waterboarding. And it is a very mixed bag. It helped him very early on. Again, it helped him get reelected. But by the end, it was also a big part of his very low approval ratings when he left office.
Now, former President Bush joined President Obama at yesterday's ceremony in Shanksville and today's events in New York. Was it striking for you to see him back at Ground Zero 10 years later?
He has been very low-key, almost invisible, except for, you know, private speeches and appearances that he's made since leaving office. This was his first face-to-face meeting with President Obama since January of 2010. That was in the wake of the 2009 tsunami, not the most recent one, but the 2009 tsunami. The two last spoke after the mission that resulted in the killing of Osama bin Laden. But seeing them today, it did seem to take politics out of this. I was at Ground Zero during the 08 campaign when candidate Obama and candidate John McCain walked down there together. That was supposed to be about unity, but it still felt about politics. This one did not. This felt like it was about the memorial and what has been created there.
And one of the more divisive issues for both these administrations has been issues of defense and intelligence. Tom Gelton, you've covered topics on national security in the years since 9/11. What is the major concern today?
Well, Audie, I think the concern is still the danger of another terrorist attack. Al-Qaeda, the terror network, is unquestionably weaker today than it was 10 years ago. Not only is Osama bin Laden dead, so are many of the other top al-Qaeda operatives. The network does not have the capability to carry out major attacks that it did a number of years ago, but there is still a great deal of concern. There's still the desire to hit the United States and Western allies. And, of course, there's concern about new types of attacks, bio-weapon attacks, even nuclear terrorism. So that remains paramount. In addition, there is the need to withdraw troops from Iraq and Afghanistan and do so in a way that does not leave those areas sort of fertile for the growth of new terrorist operations. And we must do all of this in the context of decreasing financial capability resources on the part of the U.S. government. So a whole set of concerns that are at the forefront of the defense and intelligence agenda right now.
And 10 years, two administrations, how has America's approach to terrorism changed?
You know, interesting, Adi, I'd say before 9/11, terrorism was seen more as a law enforcement challenge. You know, the World Trade Center bombing of 1993 resulted in indictments of conspirators. And after the bombing of USS Cole in 2000 and the U.S. Embassy bombings in Africa, the response of the U.S. government was really to send the FBI in or to send law enforcement agencies in. After 9/11, the war against terrorism became exactly that. It became a war. It gave rise to major land wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was no longer seen as a law enforcement challenge. It was essentially seen as a military challenge. That's the single biggest change.
That was NPR's national security correspondent Tom Gelton and national political correspondent Don Gagne. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
We each had very different experiences 10 years ago. Some mourned the loss of loved ones, others grieved for strangers, and some were born post 9/11 and know no other world. And yet, through stories, remembrances, and memorials, what is our collective memory? Award-winning novelist Edwige Dantica explored this question in a recent essay on 9/11 for The New Yorker magazine. She joins us from member station WLRN in Miami to talk more about it. Edwige, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You were in New York, living in New York at that time, and your family is originally from Haiti, and you've written a great deal about Haiti and the traumas that that country has suffered. How did that sort of influence the lens through which you saw this trauma that the States was suffering from?
I think for people like my father, for example, who had lived in Haiti through a 30-year dictatorship and had seen many horrible things, this was still the most horrible thing. And when you come from a place where we are constantly wrestling with different traumas, as recently as you had the earthquake and the cholera epidemic in which 6,000 people have died, you're always trying to reconcile daily life with trauma. I think for my family, you know, the world that they had come to in a way for safety had suddenly joined this other world. And I think it was, in a way, a rude awakening in that every place is vulnerable.
9/11 and some of its most searing images were televised, and some of the most intense and devastating parts were televised live. What does that mean for our collective experience?
I think it means that we were all there, or at least it feels as though we were all there. I think that's what is challenging ultimately about making art about something so vivid, so real. We didn't yet have the technology that we have today, where we might have had even a deeper experience, where you might have had people tweeting. But what we do have, you know, we have the phone calls. It still gives sort of this feeling of intimacy that we all witnessed something together.
You also write that it's the burden of the survivors and the curious to want to decipher those final moments.
Oh, absolutely. I think it all depends on sort of your level of closeness, of intimacy with the events. Of course, it's very different for people who lost loved ones. But it's something that as time goes by, we move away from the actual moment of it, from the heat of it, if we will. So everybody then becomes a kind of storyteller of that day. And as a writer, for me, the most compelling purpose is this issue of memory. And that sometimes these global events become massive and sort of the individual stories are left out. So then it is the burden of those who were there, of those who suffered, of those who lost, to tell the stories not only of the day, but also I think of the people, of the individuals. We entered a different period of time in all our lives, and that's important to bear witness to by each and everyone who can.
And that's also the importance of memorials and the ceremonies, I guess. I mean, what do you find that these events do for us as a culture?
Well, the memorials, of course, help us with this idea of collective grieving. We all suffered, I think, a cultural trauma that then had these repercussions that defined the decade of war. And there were all these ripples to this trauma, but initially it's a cultural trauma. And as with other cultural traumas or large-scale tragedies, you have a collective grieving process. And I think people sometimes hope that they'll grieve and then they'll move on. But the idea of moving on sometimes is misinterpreted as that you will just put this trauma down and walk away. But, I mean, as this decade has shown us, you don't necessarily get that privilege. You know, you move on with all of the baggage behind you.
Writer Edwige Dantekat, she spoke to us from member station WLRN in Miami. Edwige, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Today we'll be exploring the motivations behind works of music created by five classical composers in response to the 9/11 tragedies. Here's our first.
I'm Michael Gordon, and in 2006 I wrote The Sad Park. It is a string quartet written for the Kronos Quartet, who accompany the voices of 3 and 4 year old children. And I used their voices to tell the story of what happened on September 11, 2001. I was just hanging out in the courtyard of the school with the other parents and basically looked up and saw this very low-flying plane, and then boom. A few weeks after, my son Lev started pre-K. And his teacher would tell me, you know, that the children would be sitting around doing what they normally do, and then all of a sudden one of them would burst out something about 9/11, and then the others would start talking about this. And she said, you know, when the children start talking about 9/11, I turn on the tape recorder and I record what they're saying. It was just one of those moments, I was like, let me borrow that tape for one day. I copied it onto tape. That tape just sat on my desk for several years. The first line, two evil planes broke in little pieces and fire came. That little piece of tape is just slowly stretched, and it's repeated again and again and again. And every time it's repeated, it's stretched out. As I stretched out the audio, all this sound started to appear. And towards the end, it sounds like there are 1,000 people singing in this huge cry. It's not political. It's really just, this actually happened to me and my family and my child. This, in a sense, was just trying to grab on to a tiny bit of that moment and leave it as a document.
This story was produced in collaboration with NPR Music. It aims to explore the motivations and processes behind works created by classical composers in response to the 9/11 tragedies. You can find longer interviews with the composers at nprmusic.org. You're listening to live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News.
I'm Michael Nestor. I'm the Deputy Inspector General for the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey.
I'm Liz Thompson. I'm the Executive Director of the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council.
I'm Richard Tierney. I'm with the Office of the Inspector General for the Port Authority, and I worked in Tower 1 on the 77th floor.
10 years ago today, Nestor, Thompson, and Tierney were eating breakfast at Windows on the World, the restaurant at the top of the North Tower of the World Trade Center. Together, they rode in the last elevator down in the moments before American Airlines Flight 11 struck the building at 8:46 that morning.
We usually got there around 7:30. Because we were there every day. We had breakfast there every day. So we got there pretty much our regular time and saw the same people that we always see, the hostess, Doris, Jan,
Doris and
the waiter. We were sitting right almost in the center.
Right.
As you walked
they
in,
always sat in the center.
In the center, at the window.
I just went in, and Doris Ng was her usual divine self. She greeted me with a smile, and I was sitting facing the Statue of Liberty, and it was a gorgeous, gorgeous morning. We just commented about what a perfect day it was.
We said goodbye
to Doris, Jan.
Yeah. Dick and I got to the elevator first, and then we heard Miss Liz screaming down the hall, and we held it for her. We rode down, and I guess we were joking around or talking.
We said something to each other. Like, it was, light conversation, whatever.
Yeah. And it didn't take long. Those elevators were fast. It didn't take long, and then we got off, and the plane hit. I guess when we figured out who didn't get out, and we were the only ones that were up there that did get out, it kind of sunk in as time went on that, my God, we were the last people to leave that place alive.
I mean, I often thought if I'd had an extra cup of coffee and gone to the ladies' room, That would have been that.
Things just kind of, for us three, fell in place. For a lot of other people, it didn't, and you just kind of wandered into luck or unluck or misfortune or good fortune.
I think about how close I came, but not deliberately. It just comes upon me, this sense of kind of a disconcerting sense of how close I came to not being here today.
There was nothing you can do to change what happened. There was no right, wrong, smart, stupid. It was just a matter of, I don't know if it was luck, fate, or what it was, but you made a left turn, we're here having this conversation,
right.
You made a right turn, and we wouldn't be having this conversation,
right.
We wouldn't be here, and it was just chance.
Michael Nestor, Liz Thompson, and Richard Tierney were three of the four passengers on the last elevator down from Windows on the World. Everybody who was at Windows on the World at the time of impact, approximately 170 men and women, perished. You're listening to live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News.
You're listening to live coverage from NPR of the September 11th anniversary memorial events here on 90.3 WPLN Nashville Public Radio, 91.5 WTML Tullahoma, and 91.7 WHRS Cookeville. You can find a complete schedule for all our programs and listen to a live stream of any of our program channels at WPLN.org. Today's memorial events will continue into the afternoon with a call-in special this afternoon hosted by Neil Conan. Right now the time is 11:39. It's 74 degrees in Nashville.
I'm Noor Rahm with these headlines. As the U.S. marks the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, there's been a terrorism-related arrest in Sweden. Security police say four people have been arrested on suspicion of preparing an attack. Police evacuated an art center in Sweden's second largest city because of the threat. Crews are said to be making progress on wildfires burning in the western U.S. Evacuation orders have been lifted for many of the roughly 200 homes threatened by a wildfire in Washington state. And Academy Award-winning actor Cliff Robertson died yesterday. His career spanned six decades. It included roles playing John F. Kennedy to Uncle Ben in the Spider-Man movies. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington. From NPR News, this is live special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm Audie Cornish. Surprise, when it happens to a government, is likely to be a complicated, diffuse, bureaucratic thing. It includes neglect of responsibility, but also responsibility so poorly defined or so ambiguously delegated that action gets lost. Those words were written 50 years ago by a Nobel Prize-winning economist and historian Thomas Schelling in a book about the attack on Pearl Harbor. But our next guest quotes them in the context of the September 11th attacks and the effect on our national security system. Philip Zelikow served as executive director of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, more commonly known as the 9/11 Commission. He helped compile the original 9/11 report, and he's now written an update on the commission's recommendations. We spoke with Mr. Zelikow this past week from New York, and he told us how the government has followed through on some of the commission's key recommendations.
Our most important institutional recommendation was to create a National Counterterrorism Center, or an NCTC, that would bridge the domestic-foreign divide, that would pool a lot of the information available and make sure that somebody was working on the key problems. That actually is a substantial success. So that's on the very much on the plus side. Probably the biggest minus is the failure of Congress to change the way in which it oversees the intelligence community.
There are well over 100 different sort of departments and area of security that are overseen by dozens of committees on Capitol Hill.
Right. So you have a dysfunctional congressional management of homeland security in the committee system you just described. Then the intelligence community was used to be have its budget hidden in the defense budget. So all of its appropriations were approved by the subcommittee that does defense appropriations. But now its budget is broken out. The top line of the intelligence budget is public. So the reason for hiding it in the defense appropriations subcommittee is gone. But the defense appropriations subcommittee won't give it up.
Another issue specifically on that day was the emergency radio system for first responders. It was a huge problem, especially for the New York Fire Department. And I want to play a clip of a moment of testimony before the 9/11 Commission in May of 2004. Former Mayor Rudy Giuliani was about to give his testimony when the audience interrupted him.
These people...
This was a very emotional meeting, and later on, your commission recommended dealing with the shortage of broadcast spectrum. Can you talk about the status of this recommendation today?
We still have a problem in that there's not enough broadcast spectrum available for emergency service agencies in a lot of cities. So the commission recommended that a chunk of unallocated broadcast spectrum, is known as the D block, be set aside for the emergency service agencies to use. But to actually use that part of the broadcast spectrum, you'd need to build a lot of very expensive infrastructure and equipment to use it. And the cities and the local governments just don't have the kind of money that would be needed to build that kind of equipment. Congress hasn't been able to come up with a solution yet.
Philip Zelikow, knowing what you know, do you feel any safer today?
I do feel safer today. I think... you know, we're not safe and we shouldn't be complacent. One of the hard problems is how do you talk about this? How do you tell people that we've made things better without inviting a sense of complacency and dulling the alertness that we need to maintain? But we need to adjust to a situation where we become more resilient as a society. We have reduced the scale of this problem through actions overseas and things we've done at home. We've made things safer. So now we need to adjust to a world in which our systems are going to be attacked from a lot of different places and sources. And the measure of a society in many ways is not whether or not you can prevent every single attack. It's how do you respond when you are attacked. I think that's one of the lessons that we're absorbing as a society as we look back on the last 10 years and think about what's the best and the worst that these crises brought out in us is the gain in our maturity and our resilience as a community and how we cope with these problems and move on and go on with our lives.
Philip Zelikow is executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He spoke with us from New York. Philip Zelikow, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Audie.
9 days after the attacks, then-President George W. Bush addressed a joint session of Congress and launched the War on Terror. Among its goals, to end state sponsorship of terrorism, destroy terrorist organizations, and kill terrorists. Dina Temple-Raston is part of NPR's national security team covering counterterrorism at home and abroad. She joins us now to talk about the War on Terrorism today. Hi there, Dina.
Hi there.
In recent days, authorities have actually raised security concerns about a possible terrorist attack planned around this date. What's the latest on that?
Well, the threat hasn't really changed since we first learned about it on Wednesday. Essentially, there was some intelligence from a good source in Pakistan that indicated Al-Qaeda might have put a plan in motion to coincide with the 9/11 anniversary. But the information was incredibly vague. We understood that there were three operatives. Maybe there was an American among them. Maybe they were coming to the U.S. to launch an attack. Maybe they were already here. Maybe it would be car bombs, perhaps against transportation targets in New York City and Washington. And while, you know, intelligence officials tell us they thought this was a very good source of information, in other words, a source who had been helpful in the past, they can't find those other intelligence strings that corroborate all of this.
Right. The description has been credible but unconfirmed.
Exactly. And so they're checking and rechecking. And the latest information that we have is that nothing has popped up to change that status.
Let's talk more in general about what counterterrorism officials point to as the greatest threat facing the U.S. today.
Well, as you know, a lot's been made lately of administration officials who have said that Al-Qaeda is has lost its punch and that it's in the midst of a strategic defeat. The thing is that Al-Qaeda now has morphed. It has all these different affiliates now, other groups that believe in their same ideas, but in fact aren't related to the core group. And those are the people that intelligence officials worry about. In particular, there's an affiliate in Yemen that's known as Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And that group has American members. And it's already tried to attack the United States twice. They were behind the attempted bombing of the U.S. Airliner a couple of Christmases ago, and that failed cargo bomb plot last Thanksgiving.
The FBI came under tremendous criticism for the intelligence, people say, failures of 9/11. What effect did that have on the agency?
Well, it's hard to know, actually, where to start on how much the FBI has changed. I mean, it's essentially become a domestic intelligence service, like the United Kingdom's MI5. I mean, it used to investigate cases specifically to bring criminal prosecution. Now it sees its role as preventing terrorism before it can happen. And so it's less about prosecution and building a case for court than stepping in before the crime. As opposed to afterwards. And now the Bureau is under tremendous criticism for that. Are they going too far in actually entrapping people who might have in their head that they want to do some sort of terrorist act but never intend to attack or do anything about it? And I think right now they're kind of groping around for the right balance. But the FBI has completely changed its mission over the past 10 years more than just about any other agency I can think of.
Dina, hearing you talk about that also makes me think of this idea of sort of lone operator, people who have the potential to act as terrorists who aren't working in a formal group. How has the Internet changed the way terrorists operate?
Well, it's exactly that. It gives lone wolves power that they never had before because they can find like-minded people that they might never find before. They can find information on how to do something. I mean, the very bright side of texting and SMS that we saw for the Arab Spring unfortunately also works to the advantage of the dark side as well.
That was NPR's counterterrorism correspondent, Dina Temple-Raston. Thank you, Dina.
You're very welcome.
We now turn to the Pentagon and NPR's Tom Bowman. Tom, you were there at the ceremony this morning honoring those who died when United Airlines Flight 77 hit the building 10 years ago. Describe the ceremony.
Well, it was the top military leadership, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, and also Vice President Joe Biden was here, too, talking to some 1,200 family members and also about 150 survivors of the attacks, those who were wounded that day. And most of the, all the speakers really talked about how the attack, you know, it's still fresh. The wounds are in some cases are still raw. But they also talked about how it strengthened the resolve of the American people. And here's Vice President Joe Biden. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Al-Qaeda and bin Laden never imagined that the 3,000 people who lost their lives that day would inspire 3 million to put on the uniform and harden the resolve of 300 million Americans. They never imagined the sleeping giant they were about to awaken.
Tom, do we know how military enlistment changed after 9/11?
Well, a huge number of folks got into the military after 9/11, and they were people who worked on Wall Street, lawyers and so forth, who abandoned careers to join the military. There was a huge surge in recruiting at that time.
And how is it doing now?
Military recruiting is doing quite well, and part of that, frankly, is due to the poor economy. For a while, the military had trouble recruiting in the middle of the wars once the death toll started rising and the casualties started coming home. So they were forced to take those with who didn't score as well in the aptitude tests, who had minor crimes under their belt. It was a problem for a while, and the military was openly talking about that. Today, they're getting a higher quality of recruit, and again, part of that is because it's a pretty bad economy right now, Audie.
At the same time, there's talk that the Army and the Marines will begin to downsize once the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are over. What are you hearing about that?
Well, they're talking about maybe tens of thousands of Marines and soldiers being drawn down over the coming years. And one of the concerns that Marine and Army leaders have is that they don't want to draw them down too much. They're still involved in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's still, of course, about 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. There are repeated deployments for many in Afghanistan. So they don't want to draw it down too quickly and put an extra burden on those who remain in the military. So, but clearly with the budget the way it is now and the cuts needed, everyone is anticipating that the cuts in troop levels will likely be larger than what anyone anticipated.
And Tom, in our last minute, I want to hear what you heard from family members who were there for the ceremony today.
Well, we talked to a couple of women today. There was Michelle Michaeloff from Nashville and also Adrian Anderson from Sacramento. And they lost their cousin, Navy Lieutenant Commander Dave Williams. He was in the Pentagon that day in the Navy Command Center and was killed. And tragically, his wife was pregnant that day with her third child. And he was at the ceremony as well today, a 9-year-old boy. But what really struck me today, the most moving part of the ceremony was wreaths were laid at each of the benches, 184 benches of those who were killed. And you watch the family members, some of them almost lost in thought, sitting on the benches or walking around, hugging each other or having their pictures taken. It was really quite a moving event.
NPR's Tom Bowman at the Pentagon. Tom, thank you.
You're welcome, Audie.
NPR's Robert Siegel joins us again from New York, where he's been observing the day's ceremony at the National September 11 Memorial and Museum. Robert, give us a sense of what we heard this morning at the events at Ground Zero.
Well, the main thing that we've heard and that we're still hearing is the reading of the names of those who died on 9/11 in the towers, on the plains, at the Pentagon in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Also, those who died in 1993 at the World Trade Center in the bombing that year. And there are nearly 3,000 names that will be read. We're not quite at 2,800 yet. You can figure we'll be here for another several minutes at least. We've also seen something fascinating, Audie, which is that as the families of those who died, who were really the center of this observance here, as they enter the memorial behind the stage just across West Street from where we're looking at this from 10 stories up, They're taking to the memorial. They're the first people to actually go inside and use it. And just as people do at the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., they are finding the names of their loved ones, which are inscribed in brass around the two large pools which form this memorial, one on the footprint of the North Tower, one the South Tower. And they're making rubbings, leaving roses, but above all, making rubbings of the name of their father, husband, brother, sister, wife, who died at 9/11. And you can begin to see this memorial for 9/11 being used by people. It's not open to the public yet and won't be for some time. You'll need a ticket to enter when it does open. But now it's being used by the families who are also sitting in the grass, relaxing, enjoying as best they can this day. The president gave a reading earlier. He read from the 46th Psalm?
Yes.
President George W. Bush read from a letter that Abraham Lincoln sent to a woman he thought had lost five sons in the Civil War. I gather she didn't, as it turns out. And we've heard from Rudolph Giuliani, then mayor of New York City, who read from Ecclesiastes. So it's been, we've heard from dignitaries who have honored the families and the dead with their presence. But above all, this is a ceremony for those families. And it's a ceremony that has entailed members of the family reading the names in alphabetical order and also including a little message for their loved one who died that day. A very, very moving ceremony, a very beautiful and now useful memorial for those who lost people on 9/11.
It's interesting to see. I can see on screen here people are placing little stemmed flowers or little American flags. They're tucking them into the engravings of the names of their loved ones, as well as you said, placing paper over it with a pencil and making a rubbing of the etching.
Yes, the flags and flowers are appearing throughout. I must say the ceremony is there's a rhythm to it. People stand and they articulate and they practice the very often exotic names that they must read as they're assigned a group of a half dozen or 10 names to read. But then each gives a message to the person they lost: a bond trader, a firefighter, a passenger aboard an airplane. And one after another, you see how emotional that becomes and how it moves from a very well-rehearsed reading to a moment that's pretty difficult for lots of people, even if it is 10 years on.
Especially many of those moments, you have children or teenagers reading the names of family members.
Yes, they're addressing their father who died or their grandmother whom they barely knew or perhaps they weren't even born yet. I think that as big as global event as this 10th anniversary is, the ceremony at the World Trade Center site remains something that's really mostly about those who died and those who survived them. And there's been relatively little rhetoric, I should say, accompanying any of this very little connection to any national or local policies at all. Just remembering those who died, many in acts of courage. The great number of firefighters whom we're commemorating today, one after another, remind us of the sacrifice that was made by some pretty heroic New Yorkers on 9/11 10 years ago.
And we're going to hear some of the names being read by family members at the World Trade Center site in New York.
And my brother, Archangel Vasquez, God, we thank you very much for giving me a brother like an angel. On behalf of my mother, Ida, who's in Puerto Rico.
You're listening to live coverage of the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks from NPR News.
You're listening to live coverage from NPR here on 90.3 WPLN Nashville Public Radio, 91.5 WTML Tullahoma, and 91.7 WHRS Cookeville. You can find a complete schedule for all our programs. Listen to a live stream of any of our program channels at WPLN.org. Support the programming you value in Nashville Public Radio with a pledge today. You'll be entered in a drawing for a 9-day tour of England, Scotland, and Wales for two. Pledge now at WPLN.org. The drawing will be held Friday, September 23rd. Nashville weather for this afternoon, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly sunny skies, high in the mid-80s. Tonight, a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, the lower 60s. And for tomorrow on Monday, mostly sunny, the high in the mid-80s. Right now it's 75 degrees in Nashville under mostly cloudy skies at 12 noon.